The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Yeah. Welcome to BS Report Tuesday, and I have pressed the Red Sox panic button on the Subway Fresh Take hotline right now from Bloomberg Sports, our favorite sabermetrician. I can't say that word. Jonah Carey, what's happening?
I'm here to talk you down off the ledge, Bill. I'll do my best.
Sabermetrician?
Yeah, that works.
Sabermetrician. I was watching, don't ask me why, but I was watching George Lopez last night, and he couldn't say Cara Diaguardi's name. And they ran this whole hysterical loop of him mangling the name in a promo. It was really a laugh riot. The reason I was watching it was because I noticed last night in L.A. that he's on at Channel 9, the George Lopez show, his sitcom, is on at the same time against his TBS late night show. That's a lot of George Lopez for the same time slot.
That is, and you basically just compared yourself to George Lopez, which is good, bad, neutral, I'm not sure.
I think it's bad. I don't think it's a good thing.
That's for you to judge.
But what do you do if you're a George Lopez fan? I mean, you've probably seen all the old George Lopez sitcoms, so maybe you just watch the talk show. I don't know. Or maybe you toggle back and forth. Let's talk about the Red Sox collapse. 4-9. Mark Simon, ESPN Research, emailed me yesterday and said that no Red Sox team has ever gone 4-9 or worse in the first 13 games and gone on to make the playoffs, which made me want to like just drink cyanide. What's your take?
It's early. I think the big problem, obviously, is the two teams that they're facing in the same division. One of them just completely obliterated them for four games in Fenway Park, so that's a problem. They're six games behind both the Yankees and the Rays, and you start looking at paces, and it's a little early in the season, obviously, to look at any kind of pace, but still, I mean, you have to figure that they have to play six games better or more than one of those two teams, and that's just not going to be easy. If the Rays' true talent, for instance, is to be a 90-win ball club, which is, you know, probably about the median of what people expect. I don't think they necessarily, most people probably didn't pick the Rays to the playoffs, thought they'd be good. Well, if they're a 90-win team, then they're on pace for 93, basically. I give credit for that one to R.J. Anderson of D-Rays Bay, formerly of D-Rays Bay and now of Fangraphs. He points out that interesting pace stat. So it's the same thing with the Yankees, right? I mean, if they were 90-win team, which is unlikely, they were probably better than that, but still they're on pace for 93. If the Red Sox were 93, 94, 95-win team, all of a sudden they've got to play like a 100-win team to catch up. So, you know, I don't think that they're in horrible shape, but it's just that their division that they're in, it does put them behind the eight ball, even this early.
I watched that series this weekend thinking that if those teams played 40 times, Tampa would win like 33 of them. I mean, and I know Tampa's playing well and the Red Sox are banged up and whatever, but it just seems like a bad matchup.
Well, I mean, the Rays have they're good at everything. That's the thing is, you know, I think the big kind of downturn on them was people were talking about what was going to happen with their starting rotation, and people said, well, they don't have a Lester or a Beckett or a Sabathia. They don't have anybody at the top of the rotation. Well, Matt Garza, and it's only three starts, but he has the exact same stats as CeCe Sabathia. He's 3-0 with an 0.75 ERA. He's got filthy stuff. I mean, it's always been a mental thing with this guy that if he can just put it together, he'll be fine. What I really love about them is that if you go up to him before a game, this is like 2-3 hours before a game, he's in the clubhouse, he's listening to Tupac, and he's just in his own world, and you cannot talk to the guy. He's one of those. And he's been, you know, in the past he's been viewed as a head case. That's kind of why the Twins traded him. Everybody knew that he was talented, but everybody's like, when is he going to harness it? And they took, you know, something like cocooning himself with Tupac to be a bad thing rather than this guy is a badass and he could be a really good pitcher and let's just worry about his talent and do it that way. And he can be that ace. And if you look at the way Price is progressing and Shields is always solid, and now you go down the list and you go to Niemann and Wade Davis, if those are your 4 and 5 starters, you can't do much better than that in baseball, and the rest of it is obviously in place. We know about their defense. That's what they did in 2008. That's how they won. Their offense is very good top to bottom. I mean, they have all these other options. You know, if they lose guys, they bring in guys like Reed Brignac out of nowhere and John Jaso, their backup catcher. They just have all these options, and I would say that the Rays are a tough matchup for anybody, and I think that the Sox at this point, you know, the way that they look, it just there's this perception that the Sox just kind of they're not a very old team in some ways, but they kind of look old compared to the Rays. You look at B.J. Upton and you look at David Ortiz and you just say, how could we be dealing with the same sport? It's like they're just two different entities almost. So I think that's the frustrating part for Red Sox fans, is that even if the Sox can turn it around, you don't close your eyes and say, oh, what a dynamic Red Sox team led by Jeremy Hermida and J.D. Drew. I'm so excited. You know, it's just a different kind of ball club.
And Tampa exposes two issues with the team. One is speed and the Red Sox inability to throw guys out or basically handle that in any capacity. And then, just from watching naked eye, I think it's too early to run like the stats on this because it's only been 13 games, but it just seems like hard throwing right-handers are going to give the Red Sox trouble this year. Because Ortiz passed away 2 years ago and they don't have that lefty bat. It's basically all on J.D. Drew and Martinez to come up with some power. If you get a right-hander that goes against this Red Sox team that can just, get Yukos and Pedroia out, we don't have a lot of options.
That's
it's
right.
Depressing.
Well, and I'll give you another Ortiz one, and I'm not trying to plug Fangraphs over and over, but Dave Allen of Fangraphs did a great article in February, and he looked at Ortiz's home run tendencies by each field, like left center and right field, season by season. And Ortiz in his prime, he would just jerk the ball. He would have his isolated slugging, which is basically slugging percentage minus batting average, which just measures how much of a power guy you are. In his peak, it was like 500. So if he was hitting 300, that means he was slugging 800 to right field in his prime. That's how good he was. That's completely outrageous, and nobody really does that. And now he's back down to being kind of mortal, that he's not really a huge power pull hitter, not any better than any other slugger, and in some ways worse than a bunch of other sluggers. He's maintained his power to left and center, but not to right. This was at the beginning of the season this article was written, but we've only got 2 more weeks to go with that. I find that very interesting. I mean, you could go in a bunch of different ways. Maybe it's his wrist injury, maybe it's age, maybe it's reflexes, but it's entirely possible that he just cannot get around on that fastball and yank it into the bleachers in right field anymore. And if he can't do that, yeah, it's a problem. They need a left-handed bat. And, if they're really going to go for broke this year, Adrian Gonzalez has got to be in the scenario. And I think that if you talk about Gonzalez, he's a guy who's a team-friendly contract. You could potentially extend him. Do you sell off 3 or 4 of your best young players and go after someone like that, not only to try to get in the playoffs this year, but to maybe solidify that position, for the next little while? Maybe you move Yukalis to third base. You could do a bunch of different things because you've got some flexible pieces. But all of that needs to be considered for sure.
Well, I have my own little statistical analysis on David Ortiz, which goes like this. I've watched the games, and he can't hit the ball anymore. It just goes by him. There's my little analysis. He can't hit it. He strikes out every other time. And when he hits it, it's surprising. It's just he looks like he's done. I mean, he was bad last year, but it wasn't like this. This is different. He just can't catch up on even 91-mile-an-hour fastball.
I think you have a little bit of a short memory, though. He had 2 home runs at the All-Star break last year. And anybody who owned him in fantasy or was a Red Sox fan could tell you that it was a disaster.
But it didn't feel like this. I'd have to look at it. But I don't remember him striking out every other at-bat. But he wasn't striking out every other at-bat, though. I mean, this is like, this guy just looks done. The guy before last year just looked like a guy who was in a mammoth slump and might be getting old. And might be older than what he was advertised. This guy that I've watched this year looks like he's going to be out of the league in about 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And he's just not going to be playing baseball anymore.
That's one of the trickiest things for, people like me or people smarter than me who look at this stuff is when do these guys fall off a cliff? And you look at the history of sluggers, these big barrel-chested guys always worry me. Like Mo Vaughn. I mean, he had a very precipitous decline. And you could say whatever you want about Mo Vaughn. He was a fantastic player in his prime, but he just fell off a cliff. And you look at guys that have that kind of build and that kind of skill profile. It's what you call old player skills. You've got the walks, strikeouts, and home runs early in their career. At 26, they're already that kind of guy. I worry about guys like that. And I mean, I have to tell you, for instance, if the Red Sox were to trade for Prince Fielder, we'd go back and have the same discussion 3 years from now, maybe 4 years from now. I just think that there's going to be that kind of sudden and maybe more drastic decline, because if they lose it, if they can't get around quite on that fastball and pull it, what have you got left? Is Ortiz stealing bases or, doing great things in the field? Of course not. It's always a risk with a player like this. They're so exciting in their prime. There's a chance for a home run every time, but you wonder if they're going to go that way. I mean, it's not that only guys who have this barrel-chested build have been like that. Dale Murphy was a fantastic player in the 80s, back-to-back MVPs. He completely falls off a cliff and just becomes a non-entity. Tim Salmon went through that really tough stretch where he fell off a cliff. It's tough, and you don't want to be the team that signs a guy to a contract. Maybe it's a 4-year deal. First two are great, and by year three, it's a disaster. And that's what you worry about. You hope that it's not going to be that. You want kind of a gradual erosion rather than this guy needs to be off my roster right now.
I've written about this before, but we watched this happen with Jim Rice in
Yeah.
I think either 87 or 88. It was just over. You just knew it was that was it, and it wasn't going to come back. I remember feeling. I'm going to look up the Ortiz stats right now because I remember being like woefully concerned last year, and I even wrote a column about like, you know, it looks like this might be over, but still holding on to the shred of hope that it was going to turn around. And when he finally did hit the homer, it was like, oh, he's back, baby. This year, I'm not feeling it. And, you know, so now everything's basically on the shoulders of Mr. J.D. Drew, who is probably, would you say he's the number one most polarizing stat-friendly guys versus people who hate stats guys? He's like kind of the lightning rod of the whole thing, isn't he?
I think it used to be Adam Dunn, because I think before defense was recognized, here you had a guy in Dunn who hit 240 every year, but with 40 home runs, and he had, like, I think exactly 40, something like 4 or 5 seasons in a row, and 100 walks every year. So you had a guy who was a very good offensive contributor, but people didn't know what to do with his 240 average. But since the defensive, whatever you want to say, revolution came along, people said, okay, Adam Dunn's not actually that good, and now everybody's kind of in line. They say good power hitter, limited player. But in fact, Drew's a good defender. I mean, he does that well. He runs the bases pretty well. If you just look at his raw, you know, whatever you want to say, OPS or WAR or any stat that you want to use, his offense is pretty darn good. So, yeah, I think from that standpoint it is the case, because it's just the objective views of his value say that this guy's a good player. But it's everything, you know, Bill. I mean, it goes back to just Philly fans throwing batteries and him shirking the draft and then getting redrafted. I mean, this guy has had that kind of criticism forever. If anything, you know, I wonder why Steven Drew doesn't get booed out of ballparks. That's how much people hate J.D. Drew at this point. I mean, it's just, there's this, just his Drew legacy, and I don't know what he was going to, he'd have to cure the lepers or heal puppies or something like that to renew his reputation, no matter how good he was on the field. And then, of course, when he is bad, even when it's 2 weeks, people are going to hate him even more because, it's, you know, they feel like, oh, we don't like this guy anyway, and now he sucks.
So Ortiz, last year, April, 100 at-bats, 230. No homers, 22 Ks, 100 plate appearances, I'm sorry. And then in May, 108 plate appearances, 26 Ks, one homer, and then turned things around in June. And now I'm looking up his 2010.
That's pretty similar. I mean, he's not really worse than that necessarily. This, I mean, his batting average is lower, but it's 2 weeks.
Well, the Ks are different. So this year he's 42 plate appearances, 15 Ks, 158 average. Yeah, it's about 15%.
A little higher, yeah.
You're right. Yeah, it was bad last year. I remember thinking he would turn around last year and this year, not thinking that. But back to J.D. Drew, though.
Yeah.
Watching him day in and day out, I think the thing that stands out for me, and this is something that just the stats aren't going to pick up, it's not that fun to watch him play baseball. And you know, that's it's an unfair thing to say, because obviously his job is to be one of the 9 guys in the lineup and a good defender and to put up his stats and do all the things that he does. But at the same time, as a fan, I'm just tired of him, you know? And I think, I hate to use the Rasheed Wallace example here, but this Red Sox team, from a personality standpoint, has kind of taken on his personality to some degree. I'm not saying he's to blame. They don't have enough of the Pedroia guys, and it's a very business-like team where, you know, the pitchers take forever. I don't know what happened to Josh Beckett. I mean, he always works slow, but this year it's like 25 seconds per pitch. It's just a very gritty, business-like team that doesn't have that kind of joie de vivre. What's that word?
Joie de vivre. Yeah.
Doesn't have that feeling to it, and I don't know if that plays into that 4-9 thing or not. Now, this is a whole running battle of the stat side saying, like, this stuff doesn't matter. In my opinion, it does matter a little bit, because when a team seems like it's having fun, you can kind of see it, and it always seems to translate into something. Do you believe in that or no?
I think it's a little bit of a misconception to say that stat guys don't believe in it. We just can't prove it one way or another. It's hard to know. I mean, the fallback is always, well, chemistry doesn't build winning. Winning builds chemistry, and you could sort of go in that direction. We've talked about other sports before. I think it's certainly the case in basketball. If there's only 5 guys on the court, if one guy is just not trying on defense and doesn't rebound and he runs three-point line to three-point line like, oh, I don't know, some guy that you just mentioned 10 seconds ago, that's going to be a problem. But in baseball, it's sort of like you just kind of hit the ball or you don't. I don't know. I mean, if Euclid is pulling down people's pants in the clubhouse, does that mean you're more likely to hit a home run? Or if Kevin Millar gets re-signed, does that mean they're better? It's possible.
Probably not.
Yeah, well, but I don't know. I mean, it might be possible. There's just sort of no way to prove it. And you know, we don't have these objectives. Maybe we have to give them all the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the MMPI, and see if it's a kind of a benchmark psychology test. My wife is a psychologist. And find out, you know, if they all get MMPIs and they score high on this scale versus this one, they're high on the mania scale. Maybe that's going to be good for them. I have no idea.
Well, like, for instance, 2004, we're down 3-0 to the Yanks. Millar, and there's video of this, Millar in the pregame warm-ups talking about, you know, this isn't over, we're going to make history. He's going around to the different guys, and it didn't seem like a team that was down 3-0, whereas this team, when they lost that third game in the Tampa, and not to compare last weekend to the Yankees playoff series, but just you could just see they were headed for the fourth loss. You know, it was just waiting. I'm waiting for two or three of whoever to step up and be like, hey, guys, we're much better than this. And it just seems like kind of a grim team.
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, I mean, it's a small sample. And if you talk about anything that a stat head believes in, it's always that. We can always look at anything. The Rays in 2008, when they won the pennant, they started off horribly. I mean, they were just not a good team at the beginning of the year. They were losing. And, you know, same old Rays, nothing was going to happen. And then they came out of it. And then I can even go back, you know, to recent history. I mean, the Red Sox, are they so different than last year? I mean, it seemed like they showed more resilience last year, or maybe in 2008. Is it just that by replacing Manny they're that different? It's not that everybody has turned over. It's just that maybe we've reached this, whatever you want to say, inflection point, tipping point, that it was okay when they only lost Manny, or it was okay when they only lost this guy. But once they lose this guy and this guy and this guy, now all of a sudden they become boring or uninspiring. Yeah, it's possible. Maybe it's not the one guy leaving. It's just sort of the general turnover. And you know, Theo's talked about this being a bridge season and all that. I did pick the Red Sox to finish third this year. I mean, I thought that they would be a good team. I figured they'd win 90 games. I really kind of still believe that they can win 90 games. I'm just not sure that that's good enough. And if they were in the Central, I still think they beat the Twins. You know, if they were in the, whatever, AL West, I think they beat the Rangers and the Mariners. I just think that this is the wrong division for you to slip up even a little bit this season, because these are two monster teams in front of them right now.
Yes, and you make a great point. They're playing the Yankees in Tampa 38 times. So they're 1-7 right now against those teams. If they can turn that around and get that to 19-19, then the playoffs, I think, are conceivable, because as we saw with some of these other teams, you know, like, for instance, right now they have Texas, Baltimore, and Toronto coming up. Baltimore could not be coming along at a better time.
Yeah.
And hopefully, when do we play Seattle? When do we play that Seattle offense? When are those guys showing up?
It's going to be another 0-0 20-inning game, I think, between those two teams.
Yeah, and they have the, you know, they have the starters. They have the closer and the setup guy.
Yep.
So it shouldn't be all, you know, I shouldn't be this depressed. But, you know, sometimes with baseball, you just get off on the wrong foot and that's it. It's a weird sport that way, you know. Get momentum the wrong direction. You just can't bounce back. Now Cameron's out 6 weeks. I wanted to ask you about, did you think there was any irony in this whole pitching defense thing, and defense has cost the Red Sox at least three games?
Well, they were without Cameron and Ellsbury, and Bill Hall is not a major league center fielder. I mean, the way he misplayed the ball by Bartlett was just, people were wincing. I mean, it was, you know, I live in New England, and just it's mania what's going on here. Everybody is just freaking out about it, and of course the joke is being thrown back in their face. Hey, you know, you're supposed to be a pitching and defense team, and UZRs for frauds. You know, I feel like the 2010 Red Sox might do more to set back statistical analysis and the acceptance of statistical analysis than anything like ever. I mean, it's just it's crazy. It's just everybody's oh, you're all full of it, whatever. I can remember when Teixeira didn't have a great UZR, I guess it was last year, and everybody, there was kind of a hubbub in the New York media, and everybody's saying, oh, you guys are all charlatans and all this stuff. The Red Sox, to a man, I mean, it's happening over and over, and it's just, you could say that, but I mean, they don't have their full arsenal. Cameron and Ellsbury are good defenders when they're out there in center and left. And, you know, Beltre, I think when you get used to Beltre, when you get to see him over a full season, you'll be impressed. I mean, the guy can really pick it.
Already impressed. No, he's a vacuum. The Cameron, I haven't, even before he got hurt, I was not as impressed by. He didn't give me the same feeling. Like, I watched Franklin Gutierrez, and I'm like, wow.
Oh, yeah.
That guy is a freaking center fielder. Cameron's, you know, definitely above average, but, you know, I'm not sure he's the same guy that he was 5 years ago.
You know what?
He's 37.
He is. One thing I'd love to see studied, which I don't think has been done, really, or I've never seen it anyway, I feel like, you know, there's this whole idea of ballpark effects and how they affect everything, and it is supposed to be measured in UZR, by the way. But I want to know if quirky ballparks have specific effects on specific players. And I'll give you an example. Huh. If you watch Carl Crawford play in Boston when he plays the Monster, there's nobody. I mean, I'm barely old enough to remember much of Yaz, and I certainly don't remember Ted Williams or anybody like that. I do remember Greenwell and Rice and some other guys that they've had in left field. And I remember everybody who's played in Boston. I mean, I've lived in New England for a few years. I've seen a bunch of Red Sox games in my life. I can never remember anybody playing the Monster better than Carl Crawford. Carl Crawford is already an elite left fielder, so he's going to be good anywhere, but he has that specific knack to play that ballpark. And, you know, if you talk about a center fielder, you've got to deal with the triangle. It gets very shallow all of a sudden, obviously, when you get up to the Monster in left center. You've got the short wall. You saw Bill Hall almost impaled himself on the wall when he tried to catch that B.J. Upton home run and went out in right center. I wonder if there are specific quirks to specific players where there's some kind of instinct or some kind of something that makes them better in that park. So it could be that Cameron is a good defensive center fielder, maybe not a good defensive center fielder for Fenway. I don't even know how you would do that study, but I'd love to see it, and I bet you there's something to it.
Maybe it's one of those things where the more ground he has to cover, the better he is, but Fenway's more... I don't know, I guess there is a lot of territory in center.
Out in right center, certainly, when you get to the triangle and stuff,
But going to his right, facing home plate, not a lot of room to operate going towards left field.
No, and you would think with him and when Ellsbury are actually out there, you would think very few balls would drop in there in left center between those two guys. That's the theory, anyway.
I got this email from Keith in Enfield, Connecticut. This is after the sweep yesterday. Aren't you glad you talked yourself into the Red Sox being good? You fell for the Theo propaganda. Last year was John Smoltz. This year was made-up baseball nerd stats that tell you we have great defense and a pasting lineup. Propaganda. I'm not buying it. Whatever happened to just watching players and saying, you know, that guy looks like a good player. Instead, you and Theo resigned to checking what their VORP is. That's what you're talking about.
Have we reached the apocalypse when Bill Simmons is viewed as the stat head orthodox guy who's going to have this stuff thrown back in his face? When did that happen?
Listen, I still stand by it. Like, it made sense logically. I think the problem is, starting with Cameron, they might have gotten him a year or two too late.
Yeah, maybe.
And then the Beltre move was fine. The other issue is that Beltre is somebody who historically starts out slow. Mike Cameron... You know, going from, he was National League last year, right? I'm blanking.
He played for the Brewers?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
He's gone from NL to AL. All of a sudden, he's in a big market. The odds of him starting out slow are pretty high. Then you have JD. Who the hell knows with him starting out? You have Big Poppy, who started out slow last year. Like, you know, maybe this team was meant to kind of suck in April. I had a Yankee fan friend of mine claim to me that the Yankee pitchers always suck in April because they baby the pitchers in spring training because they're trying to get them all the way through till October. And so I was like, oh, this will be an interesting thing to follow. No, not true. So I don't know. Maybe no theories are true.
Well, there's a couple of things to what you just said. First of all, very interesting point about the babying of the pitchers. I totally agree with the general point. I do think pitchers have been too babied. And to use an example, and maybe this will come home to roost and maybe it won't, the Rays are running out their pitchers big time early in the season. This is not just the veteran guys. Price is throwing 115 pitches. We got Garza going 120. This is all occurring within the first 2 weeks of the season. They're going deep into games. And I've changed my mind a bunch of times on pitching, and it's the thing that I'm most interested in baseball. I think it's fascinating. It's undercovered by both the mainstream media and stat heads. All this stuff about how you train pitchers, you know, getting them to go deeper into games and, like, their long toss regimen and how they run and how they train, I don't think it's a given that pitchers have to get hurt and that attrition has to occur. I think we're doing it badly. I think most teams just kind of say, you know, there's still that rub some dirt mentality. And it's just on it mentality. It's just like, well, okay, 100 pitches and you're out of there. I think it's still imprecise, and I feel like the Rays, with all the metrics that they have, and they hired a guy named Josh Kalk, who's like a big pitch FX guy who understands the minute a guy looks like he might be getting hurt, they have some sense of what's going on and they could fix it. Teams that really, really, really pay attention, they can have their pitchers go longer early in games, and it's to their benefit. The Rays, as young as those guys are, you might say caution, caution, caution. Let's not do this. But they're being more aggressive with it. And one other point about Cameron, by the way, in the outfield and all the guys that they have concerns there, Hermita's got to play more. I know that he's just kind of looked pretty, you know, he's had some moments early in the season, but it's not just that. He's just a good player. His minor league career, you look at his minor league stats, I'm looking right here, career minor league on base of about 400. I mean, this guy is just an on-base machine. You're talking about a guy with good kind of doubles and sometimes home run power. He's still a young guy. He gets on base very well. We don't really know. It's hard to say, but he probably can be an adequate fielder in that outfield, and I think that they're just going to need that left-handed bat. He's not the cure-all. If they're riding on Jeremy Hermida, they're not winning the pennant anyway. But I feel like he's going to end up getting 400-plus plate appearances just because he's a pretty good player and because they're going to need him.
And you know what's funny? It's heading into my League of Dorks ale keeper, Jeff, my partner Hench and I, not my life partner, my fantasy partner. My co-owner, I should say.
Yes.
We both liked Termina because we figured with that outfield he'd get 400 at bats. Because you know JD Drew's missing his typical 27 games.
Yeah.
And if Cameron got hurt once, all of a sudden there's your 400 at bats. Isn't he like, what's he, 27, 28?
I think he's 27. And, you know, this whole going back to Bill James at 27 is supposed to be, if not the peak age, then right in there. So, yeah.
Back to what you were talking about pitchers. I agree. I think it's fascinating. And I think if you... You know, so much has changed about the baseball that we grew up with. You know, like when you think like in the 70s, if a guy stole 80 bases but got thrown out 49 times, that was considered like a good thing because he stole 80 bases.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it was just this whole you didn't milk pitch counts and you were judged by your RBI, all that stuff. But back then it was everybody pitching every 4 days. And you look at like the innings of the guys – You know, when I first started collecting baseball cards, 75, 76, like Randy Jones throwing 280 innings and year after year. And now we've swung so far the other way. I wonder, did we swing too far the other way?
I think we did. I think that if you look at Jabba Chamberlain as a classic example, and I have a feeling that he might be hurt. I think that there might be something with him that might have occurred at some point. And he just might have experienced some kind of something or other. But you just look at the Jabba rules and stuff like that. It's like, okay, well, maybe he's hurt and maybe he isn't. He's still pitching, but to what end? I mean, you didn't get the Jabba Chamberlain that you wanted. I think that he should be a starting pitcher, but they just did baby him too much. And I think the problem is pitch counts are fine if you don't do anything else. If you have no idea how to train a pitcher or keep him healthy and the best you can come up with is let's not use him too much, I guess it's not the worst idea in the world. My problem is, again, on the front end, it's stuff that has nothing to do with stats. It has to do with who's your pitching coach? Who's your strength and conditioning coach? I mentioned last time I was on that I spent a weekend with the Texas Rangers. They got Mike Maddux as their pitching coach. He's real smart. He knows a lot of cool stuff. Nolan Ryan knows a lot of stuff and can really dip into the idea that he used to throw live batting practice, that he used to run sprints instead of running long distance. Jose Vasquez, who's their strength and conditioning coach, he's got them doing all kinds of quick explosion type of exercises, which is what you need. You're not supposed to really run, you can run distance as a pitcher, but the idea is it's kind of 100 or 110 sprints per game, so he kind of gets them geared up for that. There are all kinds of things like that that I feel like are underexplored in baseball, and frankly, all the numbers and stuff like that, they're really cool, but I think there's stuff on the mechanics with pitchers and little hitches with hitters and stuff that it's hard to quantify, and I don't even know if I or anybody, not too many other people who are kind of doing what I'm doing or way smarter people are doing, I don't know if they have it covered. I feel like this is the stuff that has to come from progressive guys in the game, better pitching coaches, better hitting coaches and all that. And we still haven't found it with pitching, Bill. I mean, we're still sitting here and we're saying, oh, this guy can get hurt and this guy should do this. If you have a healthy 22 and 23-year-old pitcher and he's throwing 95 miles an hour, why can't he just be good for 10 years? Why does it have to be this minefield to get him there? I feel like there should be an easier path from point A to point B.
Well, and then look at some of the guys we grew up with. Like, right as you were talking, I looked up Jim Palmer.
Yeah.
So Jim Palmer, he threw 181 innings in 1969 when he was 24 years old. From there, 305, 282, 274, 296, 178, 323, 315, 319, 296. And then 155, 224, 127, 227. Now, if somebody threw 323, 315, 319, and 296 innings in four straight years, I think everybody would have a heart attack. It just, has anybody even come within 50 innings of that? So baseball can't be that much different. That the, you know, guys weren't created differently 35 years ago.
There's a couple of things. There's a couple of points of rebuttal. Number one is when you go through a typical lineup right now, 1 through 9, it's much stronger now than it was before. There were the Belangers and the Ray Oilers of the world and all these guys who were really, really lousy hitters. Just guys who could not hit the ball out of the ballpark, and you would have the bottom three of the lineup. You could cruise. If you want to go way back, Christy Mathewson's book back in, I don't know, the 20s or whatever, Pitching in a Pinch, he says, oh yeah, I used to take it easy 1/3 of every time through the order, and Christy Mathewson would throw 375 innings per year because he could just take it easy for 1/3 of the game. That's part of it. And the other part is, you know, you're mentioning guys like Palmer. That's really a survivor effect kind of a thing. We talk about Palmer and Ryan. We forget about all the Joe Schmoes who stunk and they washed out of baseball and they did get hurt because they were overused. And I've talked to guys like that in the past, and they say, listen, I mean, I got hurt, and they said, again, rub some dirt on it, and there was no prevention, and there was no, of course, there was no training and all this stuff. That's another thing. And they did get hurt, and I think that we just forget over the course of time. I mean, think about music, right? I mean, we remember the Beatles and Zeppelin and all this stuff. We don't remember all the garbage bands. They're never played on your local radio station or whatever. They go away. It's a survivor effect. So I think that we have to be careful. I'm not saying that pitch counts are useless. I do think there's value in monitoring things. I just think we need to come to a – we kind of need to get these roads to intersect. Let's not go nuts with these guys and have them throwing high-stress innings against, you know, shortstops who can hit 30 home runs. Let's be careful about that, but at the same time, let's try to build up their strength a little bit. Surely there's got to be a middle ground. It shouldn't just be all these blunt instruments being used. We should do it a little bit better, I think.
I thought you were going in another direction with your rebuttal, because I don't think anybody could throw 315 innings now because of the way the pitch counts work. Like, you throw a complete game in 1975, but you might throw 110 innings because half the guys are swinging at the first or second pitch. Nowadays, you don't have a chance of throwing a complete game against the Yankees.
You know why I don't? I didn't make that rebuttal? Because as crazy as it sounds, you're actually wrong, and I'll tell you why. And
I'm not really?
Yes, I'm not saying it's crazy that you're wrong in general, because that's happened once or twice. I'm saying that it's that you're wrong in this case. Joe Posnanski, who's, you know, there's nobody better than Joe Posnanski, he did a piece, and he talked about walk rates over the years, and he looked at the 80s and the 90s and the 70s and stuff like that. It's basically the same. It hasn't changed that much. And here's why.
What do you mean, the walk rates or the pitch per at bat?
Well, both, it becomes both, the walk rates and the pitch per at bats, and here's why. Right now you have guys who are trying to draw walks. There's guys like Drew, and they make their living, and they're trying to get 100 walks per season, and they're trying to get the pitchers to wear down. And with the Yankees and the Red Sox, it's patently obvious that this has taken place. But there's a counter effect. All these pitchers are being instructed to pound the strike zone and pound the strike zone and pound the strike zone. It didn't exist as much back in the day. Back in the day, the goal was just get the guy out, and you would have all these chuckleheads chasing at the ball 2 feet out of the zone, so you didn't need to be so precise, and you didn't need to gun it in there. So the pitcher's walk rates, the pitcher's attempts to lower their walk rates are balancing out with the hitter's attempts to up their walk rate.
Oh.
Yes. So although the Yankees and the Red, again, we watch Yankees and Red Sox game, and the confirmation bias would be, oh, it's so obvious, the Yankees and the Red Sox, we see this, it's so obvious. But there are all kinds of teams out there that still have hackers, and moreover, that have pitchers that are trying really, really hard not to walk the guy and trying to get out of the at-bat quicker. So it seems so, what you're saying seems so obvious, but Posnanski looked at it, and it's not true.
You know what? He made me think of this guy that I grew up who being tortured by, Mark Clear, who we had for 5 years.
Mark Clear, whoa.
And this is like a special breed of those 80s relievers where they had strikeouts. So it was, oh, he strikes guys out. But nobody cared about the walks. So Mark Clear, in 83, 96 innings, 68 walks.
Yeah.
And then in 84, 67 innings, 70 walks. This is our closer. He ended up only closing 8 games. We had to go bullpen by committee. But he had 6-7 innings, 47 hits. It was like, oh, he doesn't give up a lot of hits. But add it together and 170 base runners. You're right that there aren't those guys anymore who are
they get watched out
crazy
of baseball.
Walk stats. Yeah. But so you're saying it's like almost like a seesaw.
It is.
One side of it, pitchers getting more careful. But at the other side, I mean, hitters getting more careful. But on the other side, pitchers getting more careful.
Well, with the exception of Yunisky Betancourt, anybody who can't walk ever is out of baseball. That's usually how it goes. And on the, you know, and on the pitcher's side, yeah, I mean, just start naming guys who walk a lot of guys. If Carlos Marmol is a great example with the Cubs, he actually did walk a ton of guys over the last couple of years, and he's hung in there because he throws 99 miles an hour and stuff like that. But if he keeps going like this, he's just not going to last in the game. I mean, he's a young guy, but he could be out of baseball in a couple of years if this keeps going. He's got to get his walk rate down because it won't work. That's not how it goes in today's baseball. These guys do not succeed, and they're not pursued, and they're not paid by major league teams.
Do you think that we overdiagnose some of these pitcher injuries, and maybe we're, you know, you mentioned before we're too careful? Reminds me a little bit of parents of little kids, where it's like, oh, Johnny can't read his R's. He's got ADD. You know, looking for crazy reasons to try to explain, you know, maybe somebody's elbow is sore. Next week it's not going to be sore. Do we go too far with this stuff?
I think that it just requires more granular analysis. So when I talk to the Rangers, I talk to this guy named Scott Feldman, and I think you have Feldman in the League of Dorks, is that right?
I do. He got annihilated at Yankee Stadium.
He did get annihilated.
Yeah.
He did. And he had 17... Now, That said, he had 17 wins last year, and he had a pretty good ERA, and this is a guy who was a career relief pitcher in minor league baseball. He comes into the Rangers training regimen, and you talked about the sore arm. He would get a sore arm, and they would say work through it, but they wouldn't. It wasn't a draconian kind of thing. They asked him what kind of sore arm, describe the exact symptoms, describe this and that, and he would kind of describe it, and then they would say, okay, you know what, throw some batting practice, long toss, do a little bit. This will get you through that period of soreness, and it'll build strength so that you'll come back stronger next time. And again, this is a subjective opinion of a guy who's just coming off a 17-win season. But he said, you know what? It worked. This was just kind of the idea of not dead arm, but just kind of this tired arm thing. And you kind of, you work through it. If you're tired, you know, if you've been sitting at your desk all day and whatever, and you don't really want to work out or whatever, you're thinking, the inertia is better, but you work out and you feel better. You feel stronger. And I with baseball players, that's enhanced because they're obviously doing something high level as opposed to you or I, where, you know, the highest level thing we have to do is sit there and write a column. So I think that there's something to that. And I think that it's just, again, it's just going to require paying more attention to the specifics and not as much to kind of the broad picture.
The other thing that we never take into account with what kind of a game a pitcher throws is pickoff throws. You figure, like, the average pickoff throw is how much exertion compared to an actual pitch? Like 70%? You got to turn. You got to whip it. I mean, it counts as a throw.
The only thing is that they don't steal bases as much today. So that might be the case. I got to tell you, by the way, growing up in Olympic Stadium in Montreal, this is the single best thing about the Expos ever, was whenever Tim Raines was on base and he was the master base dealer, if they threw over to first base, they would have little cardboard cutouts of chickens come up on the screen, on the big scoreboard, and it would go bok, 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 bok. And I don't remember who the pitcher was. It was like Terry Mulholland or something. I think he threw over 12 times. There were 12 cardboard chickens on the screen.
Wow.
Stolen bases would have been so much more fun. They'd be much more fun right now if Fenway Park, if they just had giant chickens, forget Sweet Caroline or anything else that's going on at Fenway, the cardboard chickens would become revolutionary, so popular. Everybody would be like, oh my God, I can't wait for, let's say, Ellsbury.
Please.
I can't wait for Ellsbury to get on base. Let's get some chickens out there.
Are you kidding? They just got your idea sponsored by Popeyes while you're talking. They'll bleed anything they can out of that ballpark. Now, you figure, like, I'm going to track this the next baseball game I watch. I'm going to see how many pickoff throws there are. Say there's, like, 8. That should count for 8 pitches. Or say there's 2, the guy fields 2 bunts and throws it to first base. That's a pitch. And then the other thing they never factor in is when the guy has, like, the 35-minute delay. That always seems like it ends badly. You know, like, somebody's got the shutout or the no-hitter going. The offense has the 30-minute inning where there's 3 pitching changes, score 6 runs. Guy comes back out. He's ice cold. It always ends badly.
It does, but they often yank the pitcher in that situation, though.
Often, but not always.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, and this is my favorite recent example of this, with, of course, this famous Mets-Cardinals game that just happened where it was scoreless for 19, 20 innings. People were getting on Jerry Manuel's case because he was adhering so strongly to this traditional closer usage that he only used K-Rod when they had the lead in whatever it was, the 19th or the 20th inning. It was so dumb that they held this guy for so long. We were totally ripping him for the wrong reason. In fact, and he talked about this in the local papers, he was warming up 10 times in that game. He said he estimated about 100 warm-up pitches.
Oh, my God.
You talk about something. Pickoff throws are one thing. If you throw 100 warm-up pitches and you're a closer, you come into the game, how does your arm not just, like, fly off into the third base stands? I don't understand that. That's just, again, an exception, but I think that's another case where if you're talking about specifically relief pitchers, that you've got to watch for that, too. There's all kinds of moving parts that go on. This is really just an easy way for me to rip Jerry Manuel, who's just awful. Him and Tony La Russa put on a clinic in horrible managing. I've never seen a game like that. It was crazy.
How dare you question Tony La Russa? We're not supposed to question him. He's a genius.
He is a genius.
Yeah, he's a genius, all right. if you want to study how to handle relievers, just watch everything Joe Torre did on the Yankees and then do the opposite.
Any Yankee fan would agree with you, by the way. Although they did win all those championships. Maybe they didn't.
He did, but he went through relievers like razors.
But isn't that okay, though? I mean, if relievers – here's the thing about relievers. They're completely unpredictable, except for Rivera and a couple other guys. These guys, who knows? You've got all these super-duper stars. You know, David Aardsma for the Mariners was unbelievable. Who's David Aardsma? He's nobody. These guys come out of nowhere, and they wash out. So if they're good, ride them while they're good and get them out of there. I mean, that's kind of a cold way to say it, and these guys are humans, but just ride them while they're good, and then they're eventually not going to be good, whether you don't use them or you do use them. They're so unpredictable, relief pitchers. That's the hardest thing to predict in baseball is that.
I agree and I disagree. I think you do that with setup guys, but you don't do it with your – if you have, like, Rivera, you don't do it.
No, not with Rivera, but with Mike Stanton and Joe Nelson or whatever.
Scott Proctor. Scott Proctor should have filed a lawsuit against Joe Torre. I think he pitched in every game for the first 3 months of the season 1 year.
And Tanyan Sturt should have sent him a Christmas card for getting into any games at all.
You're right, though. Like, you know, we picked John Roush in our AL Keeper League, yep, hoping that he'd be good. The guy's a stud, or at least he is so far until he loses his confidence. But, you know, they were going to go bullpen by committee. They got this guy from the Nationals. Who the hell knows? Now all of a sudden he's 7-0 in saves or whatever. It makes you think, like, how much of this is just mentality? How much of this is just not being afraid versus actually having the quote unquote tools to be the closer?
I'm still a little skeptical about that. I mean, there are cases where there are guys who become closers and you just look at them and you know, oh my God, this is a disaster. And obviously BK Kim is the one, you know, classic example in recent years. This guy just didn't want to be out there. I mean, I think that's the case. But the thing about Major League Baseball that's great is that all this stuff is weeded out so long ago. It starts in Little League. If you're afraid of the pitch, you're not advancing. You're not going to be a guy in the next level. And then you get to high school. And if you can't hit in the clutch, if your knees are literally knocking, you're not getting a college scholarship and you're not getting drafted. And you go on to college and you go on to AA and AAA. If you can't handle pitching in high leverage situations, or you can't handle being clutch, or you know, coming up in the eighth and ninth inning against a fire breather, you're just not making it to the next level. And that's the thing about baseball, is that people ascribe all these personality traits. This guy can't handle it, this guy can't, this guy can't. It's probably not true. Teams are smarter than we give them credit for. Most of the time, these guys who just are head cases and have no ability to do it, they get wiped out. You never see them make one pitch or take one at bat in Major League Baseball because the selection process is already too careful. I think that it's just, it might be that they're just not that good. It's possible they don't have the ability, but I'm reluctant to say, okay, it's a psychological thing, because again, there's so many mechanisms in place to keep those guys out of the game in the first place.
Everyone who watched Calvin Schiraldi disagrees with you.
Yeah, and there are outliers, of course. There's Schiraldi, there's Kim. I mean, there's, you know, Andy Hawkins in New York, maybe.
But like, I watched John Roush, and to, you know, for him, it seems like attitude. And, you know, his stuff isn't, like, overwhelming. I get nervous every time he comes in the game. He's got a tattoo on his neck. He's got this attitude like, I'm the closer. Screw Joe Nathan. It's my job now. And I do think that you have to be that way to some degree. And you think of, like, how, you know, somebody like K-Rod would get so charged up when he's out there.
Yeah.
When you watch K-Rod the last 8 years, did you really feel like you were watching one of the best closers, like, stuff-wise of this generation?
At the beginning of his career, absolutely.
Beginning of career, yes.
Ridiculous.
But the beginning of his career, not the end of his career, not the last 5 years.
No, definitely not.
You just felt like somebody that you could get to, or at least I always felt that way with the Red Sox. But quickly, let's talk about top three things you're most surprised by this season so far, and then we'll let you go.
Okay, well, I mean, the sample sizes are small, so again, I'm a bit reluctant to get into anything that's really, oh my God, look at this, look at that. But I don't know if it's a surprise so much as it's cool to see the San Francisco Giants doing some things well. And Zito has been pitching really well so far this season. And again, I'm going to go to my pitching nerd background. So there's a guy named Alan Jager. He's a big long toss specialist or whatever, and he's been working with Zito for a long time, and then he stopped working with him, and he ran into some troubles, and then he started working with him again before last season, and he told everybody he knew, hey, Zito's going to come back, and he's going to be a pretty good pitcher. He's not going to be a $120 million guy, but he's going to be good. He was pretty good last year, actually. He had a nice improvement. He's looked very nice this season, and now you match him up with Lincecum and Kane and Jonathan Sanchez. I mean, that's a very strong rotation. The lineup is very frustrating. You got Sandoval and a bunch of guys who can't hit. But if they can do something, if Sabian will just reach out and say, okay, you know what, screw it, I'm going after whatever, the Matt Holliday equivalent at the trade deadline, just make those one or two moves, you can get in. I don't know if you're winning the West. I really like the Rockies, but I think you've got a shot at the wild card or something. And Giants fans, I don't know, since the Bonds era, they've sort of had it bad. I mean, it's been all this stuff has kind of fallen off the cliff. They can't hit. Lincecum is great, mind you, but it would be pretty cool if they got in. I mean, that starting pitching can carry them a long way. They've got a good closer. Sandoval's great. They're maybe one bat away from really being okay. This is a Giants team that could be taken seriously.
I have to interrupt you for a second because I did some sort of thing about tortured fan bases after the Vikings Saints game.
Yep.
And I threw the Giants fans in there. I was like, this is like the lost tortured franchise that nobody ever talks about. The 2002 World Series.
Yeah.
Was about as bad as it gets, and it's, you know, it's not like they had all these other great moments to look back at, and then the best thing that ever happened to them in the last 20 years was Bonds, who turned out to be this guy that they're almost ashamed of. That'd be nice if they made a comeback. I'd be fired up for that. And I have the perfect hitter to help their offense.
Who's that?
JD Drew. Make us an offer. We'd love to give you a new right fielder.
That's I don't know who they could send back. They have no bats to send back. That's the problem.
Whatever. We'll talk about it. We'll figure it out. All right. What's thing number two?
I'm looking at thing number two. You know, one thing which has been interesting to me so far is the White Sox. You know, there's been differing opinions about what the White Sox were going to do this season. I didn't like them. I thought that they would struggle. Now, obviously, they're off to a really slow start. They got three wins so far. And some of the early, again, and this is all small sample stuff, but some of the early starting pitching performances are not so great, and that was supposed to be the strength of the team. And I always wondered about that. I mean, Burley, I thought, was going to be, you know, he's always a guy who's pretty steady and all that. But Peavy, was he ever going to be that guy in San Diego where you're pitching in the National League in the friendliest park in the majors and all this? And even if it all did work out, wasn't this just the American League's version of the Giants, but the Giants that we thought they were going to be not very good, where you've got good starting pitching, but, man, just really not much else. You know, Beckham's a good young player, but you just look at some of these older guys, Pierzynski and some of these aging players, and they used to have Dye, who was a contributor, and now they don't. It's just, I'm not sure if we should be surprised exactly or not about the White Sox. I didn't like them, but it could be really ugly. I mean, it could be one of those seasons. There was one year, Ozzie Guillen, it was like 06 or 07 or something like that. It was maybe 2 years. I don't know if it was 1 year after the World Series or two, but Ozzie said that if the team doesn't win X number of games, I don't remember what it was, 85, 90 or something like that, he said they should fire me. And I can remember thinking, bye-bye, Ozzie. And all the stat heads were like, you're gone. You know, it's not going to happen. They won 72 games that year. Pacoda had them pegged. All the big stat systems had them pegged. I just wonder, is this a bye-bye Aussie year? Is this just everything kind of falls apart? The young guys don't come up quick enough. The old guys are too old, and then that's sort of the end of this White Sox era. I think it's actually possible.
Doug Fister, is he going to have the greatest FIP ever this year or what? Reverse FIP.
Last year, I wrote a piece for RotoWire, RotoSite, and I said it was April. And I said, this year's Cliff Lee had that big 2008 season. He won the Cy Young and all this stuff. And I said, this year's Cliff Lee is going to be Jared Washburn. I love Jared Washburn this year, I said. They have Gutierrez in the outfield and Ichiro, and I love that ballpark, and he's a left-handed flyball pitcher. And Washburn had made one adjustment where he had a new pitch in his arsenal. I can't remember if it was a cutter or a change or something like that. I said, I love Jared Washburn. Go load up on Jared Washburn. Buy 50 Jared Washburns for your fantasy team, and you're going to do great. And while he was with Seattle, he was unbelievable. He was fantastic. He was, a left-handed flyball pitcher with so-so stuff, but with a great defense, a great park, and any weaknesses that he had would be shunted by all that stuff. And it's exactly what happened. He went nuts. I thought Ryan Roland Smith would be this year's Washburn, which in turn was the 2008 Cliff Lee. Maybe, maybe not, but Fister profiles that way too. Here's a guy with so-so stuff. He's vulnerable in almost any other ballpark in front of any other outfield in baseball, but because of the circumstances, he's going to look a lot better. You know, this whole idea of UZR and we try to build a good defense, it's not just, okay, you've got this many UZR points in there, therefore that it equals wins. It's stuff like Clay Buchholz is in the fifth inning and he's in a jam, and he throws a pitch and it's hitting the gap, and if it falls, that's three runs that score, and Buchholz, and you know, his confidence is shot and his pitch count is up, and we got to pull him and we've got to bring in Scott Schoenweiss. As opposed to whoever, Cameron Ellsbury, whoever it is, makes a catch, gets him out of the inning, he settles down, he goes to the sixth, he gets into the seventh, now you're with Bard, now you're with Papelbon, game over. And to me, that's what pitching was about, and that's why I was excited about Washburn. And although Fister has even worse stuff than Washburn, which is saying something, more likely than not, it's not going to work out for him, but there's always that possibility because of that defense, because of that ballpark, and I think that people don't pay enough attention to that, not only from the raw defensive standpoint, but how much it can affect each and every pitcher on that staff.
We had it in our AL Keeper League. We had a couple guys. Ian Snell went for, you know, Ryan Roland Smith went.
Yep.
Nobody picked up Fister, a $1 free agent pickup in week one. Now headed for 25 wins, Doug Fister.
No doubt.
And also, one of the really five or six great porn names ever by an athlete.
Well, Chip Carey, I mean, you know, before he was unceremoniously bounced away from his gig, he had made a history. It became a Twitter meme that all balls were being fisted all over the place. And so,
yeah,
to see the success of Fister is really just tremendous to see that bounce back.
Last question, then you're leaving.
okay.
No hitters. Now that we live in this era of on base and, you know, a walk's as good as a hit and OBP is more important than batting average, why do we even have no hitters?
I mean, they're one of the great things in baseball. You know, Jimenez walked all these guys. The one no-hitter I ever attended, by the way, 1991, The pitcher had 10 strikeouts and 7 walks.
Joe Cowley?
No.
Oh.
That's funny. It was the attendance was maybe 5,000 people that game. It was at Olympic Stadium. And it was a guy named Tommy Green.
Oh, Philly.
Right. Well, you know who Tommy Green is because you're a baseball fan. Nobody else knows who Tommy Green is. I'm not saying that Jimenez is Tommy Green, but I'm saying it takes a little bit of the luster off of it when, let's say you're not pitching a perfect game.
A little. He walks 6 guys.
Well,
it's ridiculous.
That's what I'm...
Hey, they're jumping on him? Oh, congratulations. You only let 6 base runners in the game. I mean, it's 2010 where we all agree now that the way we used to evaluate baseball maybe wasn't the greatest. And if you walk 6 guys... I mean, fine, celebrate, but just handshakes. I don't need people hugging each other and acting like the 1980 U.S. Olympic team just beat Russia.
Do you believe in miracles? Yes, 6 walks.
Yeah. Do you believe in miracles? I just pitched a no-hitter and walked 6 guys. But the good news is I didn't walk anybody for the last 4 innings.
You know, there are a lot of baseball milestones, not a lot, but there are several baseball milestones that are kind of random and they don't really demonstrate dominant skill. Like, what do you do about a guy who hits for the cycle? That's really good, but what if he hit 4 home runs? Like, 4 home runs is
right.
A much better. Or, okay, let's say 2 home runs and 2 triples. That's obviously much more valuable.
The cycle's stupid.
It is stupid.
Like, it's like you just said. Like, so you have 2 homers, a double, and a single, but that's not the cycle?
Yeah.
He could have. So if I hit the second homer as the last one, I should just not touch home plate, get tagged out, and I get to go down in history?
Well, and all this base 10 stuff in baseball, too, like, oh, my God, 199 strikeouts, who cares, but 200 is big. Or, you know, if you go in the Hall of Fame and you've got this many hits, 300 wins or 3,000 hits or whatever, that's a big deal. But if you've got 2,800, this whole Bert Blyleven debate about the Hall of Fame, he's got, like, 275 wins, and he's got this many strikeouts but not this many. It's just, like, we're just so predictable as human beings. We just, oh, yeah, I have 10 fingers, so if it's not, divisible by 10 or 100 or whatever, I don't really care. There's all this weird, weird, random stuff that we just can't get over. There's some quality involved, for sure, but it just doesn't really fully hit home. It's just like these random, random criteria. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe you have to go with that with no-hitters, too.
Well, my wife actually asked last year, or 2 years ago, when Buchholz pitched a no-hitter.
Yeah.
She was like, so nobody reached base? And I was like, no, I actually walked a couple guys. Well, then how is that a good thing? If the guys got on base, that's not a no-hitter. It's like, well, there weren't any actual hits. Like, she was, like, confused by the whole thing. I'll tell you another thing that's stupid. The stolen bases should just be a plus-minus stat.
Hmm.
You steal 60, you get thrown out 13, you're plus 47 for the year. We say somebody is the steals leader, but basically you can become the steals leader but get thrown out 35 times if you wanted to. Be like, hey, I led the league in steals.
Well, I think a lot of stats in baseball can be done on a plus-minus basis. What about reaching base versus outs made? Nobody ever mentions this guy made this many outs. He hit 20 home runs or whatever. What about the fact that he made like 500 outs, that he was just an out machine? You either do something successful in your at-bat or you don't. So if you wanted to slice and dice it that way, that works for me too. I think that the way on-base percentages, okay, people have kind of accepted that. But if you just say, look at this guy, he made so many damn outs, you'd be like, wow, he really sucks. I thought he sucked because he had like a 307 on base, but 500 outs, that's a lot of outs. You know, double plays and stuff doesn't take it into account. Like Jim Rice used to hit into a ton of double plays, and he was a little bit overrated as a result of that and other reasons. And, yeah. I think we're missing it a little bit.
So there's no stat that incorporates double plays?
Well, it just has double plays. It just would say, okay, this guy hit into this many double plays.
No, I know, but like there couldn't be some sort of OPS stat that also like we subtracted for extra outs that came from a double play and stuff like that. That'd be interesting.
I'm going to guess that the advanced stats at WAR and stuff like that do take it into account, but I cannot say 100% for certain. I know that on Baseball Reference, they do rank out seasons. That's a lot of fun. You can spend an afternoon just looking at, oh, look at 1976. Oh, my God, this guy was just an outs machine. You know, everyone's like, oh, I want to see how many home runs. No, I'm a masochist. I want to see exactly how many outs this guy had in this particular year. I think that's kind of fun. Failure is underrated.
Hey, you just planned the rest of my Tuesday afternoon.
Nice.
Jonah Carey, we'll read you on BloombergSports.com. Talk to you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Jonah.
Thanks
Joe.
Jonah. All right.
Talk to you soon.
Talk to
you. Bye.
We're going to call Jacko really quick.
Complex Litigation, this is John.
Oh, Johnny.
I was wondering if I was ever going to hear from you again.
Yeah.
You okay?
I'm all right.
Is he okay? You sure?
I'm all right. I mean, this is not going to be a fun season for us on the podcast.
Wow. My God, it turned ugly there quick.
We're 6 games behind, and it was in marathon day. It was yesterday.
Wow. Wow.
Go ahead, do your gloating. I call when the going's good. Here I'm calling when the going's bad. Go ahead, do a little gloating.
That's good. No, please. I can feel your pain. You know, the Yanks have struggled out of the gate in April, and it's not a fun team for you to watch. I mean, it's not a very good team.
Not a very good team. I'm not as depressed as you'd think I am, because this team isn't really fun to watch.
No, I mean,
it's not like the chance to spend October with this team right now isn't something that I really want to pencil into my schedule.
There's no offense. There's no compelling marquee player.
Yeah, that's a problem.
I mean, you know, in the glory years when you had the group of idiots and you had Damon and you had Manny and you had the old Big Poppy who was alive, they had a lively group that you could, you know, I guess you could root for if you were a Sox fan, and people were into it, and the beards and the long hair and all that. And yeah. Cowboy up and everything else. But, I mean, this team has no personality, no life, no spark. It's a dud.
It's like a bad double date where your wife's friend brings the husband who's the complete dud, and you're like, oh, man.
Yeah, right.
It's going to be a long 2.5 hours talking to this guy. That's the 2010 Red Sox.
Exactly. And it would be one thing if they were playing well, and you'd be like, well, they're sort of faceless drones, but at least they're putting up numbers. But when you're faceless drones and you're scoring one run a game and you can't get out of your own way, it's got to be even worse.
Yeah, it's basically Pedroia's. I keep waiting for them to turn Pedroia into a faceless drone, like the end of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Right.
All of a sudden, he won't make jokes anymore and smile or anything. Yeah, it's pretty depressing. I'm not gonna lie. And
I'm not gonna lie to you. It's been fantastic. I've enjoyed every minute of it. I enjoy listening to the Boston Sports Radio on the way home. I enjoy reading the comments on the Boston Globe feature or on ESPN that feature trade proposals of ways to get Adrian Gonzalez, where somehow Manny Del Carmen is the centerpiece of the trade. I enjoyed one guy's strategy that I read today of moving Euclid to left field and Victor Martinez to first base, having Veritek catch every day. I thought that was a good plan.
Is that somebody with an IQ over 80 having a plan?
I'm not sure. It's enjoyable to read the stuff. I mean, God knows every sports team has fans that are idiots, Yankees included, maybe more than included. But I have to say that I love it when the Red Sox stink, because everybody's jumping off the bridge and everybody's out on the ledge. And I would have thought that 2004 and then certainly 2007 would have eliminated that from the ranks of Red Sox Nation, the sky is falling theory all the time. But it's really come back in droves, because now they have more of a sense of entitlement than they used to. And because 95% of their fans think baseball was invented in 2004, they're not used to a culture of losing or a culture of the Red Sox not having an amazing amount of success. So it's even more enjoyable for me, and it's even more shocking for them. So,
and then there's the old fans like myself where it feels so familiar to be in that
right.
Losing situation again.
And the old bitter fans could come out of the woodwork and be like, "Ah, we told you,
yeah.
It wasn't gonna last."
My friend Hatch is in rare form.
Really?
Just, the poison is just oozing out of his emails. Like, he can actually see the cyanide. Yeah, you know, it's early.
Yeah.
1-7 against Tampa in New York. Maybe we could turn that around. I think that the bigger issue is that, you know, it's just not a fun team to watch.
I mean,
and that's the inexcusable part.
I don't want to gloat too much, and now that you've called me and I've gloated a little bit, there's no doubt in my mind that Javier Vasquez will give up 15 runs tonight, and Wakefield will probably pitch a one-hitter. So tomorrow this podcast will look very different. But having said that, I mean, the Red Sox pitching staff, those guys are going to come around. Now, I think they're a little overhyped. I mean, I don't think John Lester is one of the five best starters in baseball, as he's often proclaimed to be in Boston. But, I mean, he is solid. He will pitch better than he has so far. Beckett is pretty good, you know, obviously. So there's some hope there. But I don't know if there's any hope offensively, quite frankly. And everybody that compares them to last year's Yankees and says, well, you know, the Red Sox had beaten them 8 in a row, and the Yankees came back and won the World Series, and the Yankees were however many games out they were in April. The Yankees were also without A-Rod for like 20 games last year, which affected Teixeira, and there's no A-Rod coming down the pike. To quote Rick Pitino, A-Rod's not walking through that door in Fenway. So yeah. I'm not quite sure the comparisons are apt, let's put it that way.
Do you think it's time for Bud Selig to rip a trade for us?
Absolutely.
To rig a trade?
Yeah, I think he's probably calling San Diego, and somehow Adrian Gonzalez will be traded for Manny Del Carmen and Big Poppy's contract.
I am not as optimistic about Mr. Gonzalez as some of my other Red Sox brethren.
Well,
it doesn't make sense to me why the Padres would trade him. He has a cheap contract.
Right.
Have him this year and next year. What do you want to trade that guy for?
And it's the only marquee guy they have out there.
Yeah.
And
you're basically mailing a giant turd sandwich to all of your season ticket holders and your fans.
Right.
And we don't really have that much to give up for him, unfortunately.
The other thing nobody talks about when everybody's pounding the table in Boston saying, get us Adrian Gonzalez. Where's Adrian Gonzalez playing? You got Euclid at first, you have Beltre at third, plus you have Lowell on the bench who could play third. Where's Gonzalez playing? You have a DH in either Lowell or Big Poppy. The Red Sox would have to eat Big Poppy and Lowell's contract and put Gonzalez at DH?
Yes.
Well,
the short answer to that question is yes.
I enjoy that then, because you know, for years all I've heard is, well, the Yankees can just bleed money and they can afford to make mistakes and eat money, but we're the Red Sox. We don't do things that way. Well, welcome to our world.
The other option I think would be maybe you'd see. I don't think they could get Gonzalez without putting Ellsbury in the trade. So.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So you maybe see Yukos go to left field, which would be a barrel of laughs.
Oh my goodness. I enjoyed his work out there last year when he had to play a couple games out there.
And
you got Mike Cameron seems like a good guy, and when he told us, I read a little bit about the kidney stones, and that's one thing that scares the hell out of me is the notion of ever having kidney stones.
Yeah, it's in my top three things that I never want to happen.
Oh my God,
first, but it's definitely in the top three.
It's up there, you know, just in terms of the pain. And he was like, I don't even want to talk about what I went through. I'm like, oh my God, that just sounds horrific. And now he's got this abdominal strain that doesn't sound good at all.
Well, since he's out for 6 weeks, I would agree with you, Johnny.
Yeah. And that's a conservative estimate.
I think he would, too.
Yeah.
The problem is, I watched him for two games, and I was like, wow, this guy's a little older than I thought he might be. And he was 37, but just like legitimately, I felt like it was like somebody I would have been on our hall in college, like that level of age.
Well, I saw an interview in the locker room with him, and he didn't have his hat on. I'd never really seen him out of uniform, and I'm like, wow, that guy's really old.
Yeah.
Like, without his hat, he looks older.
So I go into my Red Sox experience with Mike Cameron feeling that he's old.
Yeah.
And now he's had trouble passing kidney stones and he has an abdominal strain. How old is this guy?
Yeah, really. Yeah, that's not good. You don't see a lot of kidney stone injuries in professional athletes.
No. I mean, I know it happens, but it's something that I think would be more likely to happen to my dad, to have an abdominal strain and to pass a kidney stone.
Yeah, it normally happens when you're over 50, I think.
They might have just gotten him a year or two too late.
Yeah, signing a 37-year-old guy who wasn't that successful in the National League might not have been the best plan in retrospect.
Yeah. I bought into the whole stat thing with him, but I think, unfortunately, those stats are based on a guy who no longer exists.
Yeah, and the Red Sox tried to peddle this notion of, you know, the whole defense thing and run prevention.
Yeah.
You know, their defense has not looked good. This notion that Adrian Beltre was the second coming of Brooks Robinson hasn't really lived up to the billing thus far.
Well,
he lost the ground ball in the lights the other day.
Hey, I think he's a vacuum. The Scudero is somebody that...
Another one.
People have made the mistake of thinking, because this is the whole defense thing, he's okay. I mean, he's like slightly better than average, and the stats say that. But he's not, you know, he's not Alex Gonzalez or anything like that.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, and then Cameron, I just don't think he's... He's definitely a good center fielder. He's above average. He's better than Ellsbury was last year, but he's not Franco Gutierrez.
And the big problem they have, and I think it's the elephant in the room, is Victor Martinez, who I read the other day that when he caught last year for the Red Sox, their staff earned run average was over 5. And apparently he was terrible in Cleveland as a catcher. And when he
terrible is overstating it.
And when he catches, it apparently hurts his offense. So you have him in a position that he's ill-suited for, which makes his hitting worse. It's a great plan all around. That's fantastic. And he couldn't throw anybody out.
Nah, he's got some issues.
The amazing thing is the Red Sox, teams have been successful 22 out of 23 times. I was there for the one caught stealing. It was there at Fenway against the Yankees. Robinson Cano got caught stealing.
Did he fall or something?
I don't know. Well, part of the problem was where my seats were. I couldn't see second base, so I'm not sure if he like tripped on a pebble or something. I'm not sure what it was, but yeah. I'm hoping that's the only caught stealing they get all year, so I can tell my grandkids someday that I was there for it.
Well, you really enjoyed this. I feel like I deserve it since I tainted your world title last year.
Absolutely.
By playing the Clips, besmirching
Mariano
on the team.
Yeah, it makes me even more joyful.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at the stats now that you mention it. As a catcher last year, he hit .281, .783 OPS, and as a first baseman last year, .329 with a .942 OPS.
Right.
That's an issue.
And they can't play him at first because they have Uke there. And I guess they're going to have to do something with Big Poppy, and some of these guys are going to have to get more time at DH.
When you say do something with Big Poppy, do you mean shoot him?
Something's going to have to be done. I mean, they may want to go rent Old Yeller and see some options. But, I don't know what they do. I mean, he's due $12 million this year, and he's not putting up $12 million numbers.
No.
Like, you know who I love, though? The thing that I just don't understand is everybody in Boston on the radio and the newspaper and everything is killing Big Poppy. And partly that's because I guess he had all the heroics, and his fall from grace is more glaring. But the guy who skates under the radar, and I'll never understand, is J.D. Drew. I mean, J.D. Drew makes $14 million as a corner outfielder, and he's hitting .136. He's never had over 70 RBIs for the Red Sox, and somehow people go down in their basement on their computer and come up with these stats that show that he's really underpaid.
Did you just use the basement?
I did.
What, are you trying to anger people?
Yeah, I'm just on a roll here.
Come on, Johnny.
I've now locked it in that Javier Vasquez will give up some record for runs tonight.
I'm looking up this J.D. Drew stat because I don't believe it. 64. Oh, you're right. He's never had more than 70 RBI. But RBI don't matter. We've proven that RBI don't matter.
That's right. You don't want somebody that knocks in runs from a run-producing position.
It's all luck, Johnny.
That's right.
RBI is a factor of who got on base before. It actually means nothing. His OPS is fantastic.
The Red Sox not only have emphasized stats, but they now have a system where they make up their own stats that they consider important.
Well, I'm just saying, people have proven that RBI is a useless stat.
RBIs are useless, and stolen bases against you are useless. It's okay if people just circle the bases like Cal Crawford. It's fun.
We gotta create some sort of intro for you as cranky old baseball fan. Maybe some song. He hates sabermetrics. He loves RBI. No, I mean, RBI really is, it comes down to who's batting in front of you.
Well, that's true to a degree, but still, I mean, it's reflective of some clutch hitting or timely hitting, certainly. Doing it with runners in scoring position when the pitcher bears down, that bears something out, I think.
I mean, I can't disagree, but we have stats to show that JD is runners in scoring position. Well, 167 this year, 1 out of 6. That's some trouble. Let's check out last year, though. That was a pretty small sample size. Scoring position. Well, .213 last year. Not great. Some trouble, Johnny. Scoring position, 2 outs, .280. 1.138 OPS, though.
Yeah, that's what everybody goes crazy about. He's got a wonderful OPS. He's worth $14 million. Give me a break. He stinks.
Cranky old baseball fan, Jacko.
I am. I'm old school.
You know, the only thing, my only defense of your attack on JD is that he does have a knack for these strikeouts in big spots. And there's no way to keep a track of this stat, but just that suck the life out of you when you're watching. And suck the life out of the crowd. Just like these random, like, we just hit a homer, now there's a guy in first base, and we're about to knock the starter out, and JD takes the call third strike. He has a lot of those moments. And I don't know if over the course of the year, there's only 3 more moments like that than other guys would have, or 5, but it feels like 100.
I mean, plus the thing, I mean, as long as the Red Sox are inventing stats, you should be able to invent a stat of he led the league and sucked the life out of me moments.
We should be able to keep track of that, though. He's had like 3 already this year.
I like that one. That's a good one.
Just like, oh, really, JD? You ain't just going to let that fastball go down the pike, right? Just not even that.
Yeah, and that's what kills Red Sox fans, is he does it all with seemingly no emotion whatsoever.
Yeah. Because it's an emotional city.
Throw a helmet or something. Make the fans happy. Break a bat.
We like emotion.
Absolutely.
How are you feeling about the Yanks?
I feel good. I feel really good. Teixeira's done nothing. A-Rod hasn't done much, and they're 9-3. Yeah. The starting pitching has looked really, really good, with the exception of Javier Vasquez, who I despise. And I told you I was going to despise, and that's rung true.
Well, at least the fans gave him a chance.
Yeah.
Well, they give him one inning.
He had the shortest leash in the history of mankind with
Neo. I didn't even think it was a leash. I think they just had him by the back of his neck.
He's lucky he didn't get booed at the opening day introductions, frankly.
I was actually disappointed that he didn't.
If I was there, I would have, trust me.
Yeah, it's a trouble when your GM is coming out and defending you when you've been on the team for a week.
Right. Well, somebody sent me an email, a friend of ours, and it said, or a link to something, and it said how they found he has some mechanical problems. They're working out the kinks. Yeah, that's it. That must be it.
Yeah, it sounds like the old Dice K.
I'm not a huge fan of Nick Johnson either, which I wasn't before the season. I do like that he walks all the time, but I'd like him to maybe make some contact once in a while. One game would be nice.
The thing I don't understand about Nick Johnson is it just doesn't seem like he's ever going to swing.
No, I know. They should just throw it right down Broadway. He's
yeah, I would just
over.
Be like, just hey, listen, if you throw Nick Johnson a ball, that's a $10,000 fine.
That's right. Yeah, he looks him over, that's for sure. He gets his money's worth.
He certainly does.
But no, I'm head over heels in love with Curtis Granderson.
As I knew you would be.
I mean, I love Curtis Granderson.
Of course you do.
And he and Brett Gardner have brought an element to the Yankees that they haven't had in a long time of a little speed on the base paths. Shakes teams up. I always like that to go with the power. I love those two.
Hey, Jonah Carey just sent me some numbers, and I'm going to leave you on this note, Johnny.
All right.
The 2008 Rays started 7-10.
Yeah.
The 2003 Marlins started 9-11.
Okay.
Your world champion 1999 Minnesota Twins started 2-9.
Wait, the Minnesota Twins didn't win the World Series in 1999. 91. Oh, 91. Okay.
Kirby Puckett.
There you go.
And Jonah says, keep the faith, Bill. Not over yet. Yeah, I'm going to do that, Johnny.
All right.
We'll talk to you in a week.
Sounds good, buddy.
See ya.
Take it easy.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.